it's important for people to understand that, oh, I'm really appreciative of being seen as an influencer, but I run a company.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Heads Talk with me, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter, the podcast where we talk to C-level executives, leaders of institutions, and heads of multinationals. What are the current topics? They talk, we listen.
Can you imagine getting into a business or a market where you actually spend $100 billion plus on a piece of paper?
Are you kidding me?
It was like a frying pan to the head.
I got nothing against CFOs.
It was not just the job of a lifetime, it was the job of 1,000 lifetimes.
My guest today is a recognized finfluencer, often rewarded and cited in the top fintech influencer blogs, lists, magazines, and conferences for her work in both traditional banks and disruptive fintech companies. Leveraging her gained perspectives, she addresses digital transformation, cryptocurrencies, blockchain, and innovative payment solutions. In her role as a C-suite executive and founder, she assists clients in navigating payment strategies, complexities, drawing on her expertise to drive formulation and implementation. A riveting conversation ahead, but before we get into that, here is a brief message. This episode is sponsored by Axia. Axia is the leading private cloud platform in the Alessian and Mattermost ecosystem, combining intelligent solutions with security and control. Axia's clients profit from digitalization and automation of critical business processes in a cloud and hybrid architecture. 150 staff provide migration, engineering, and support services to over 200 leading organizations in 32 countries.
Heads Talk Podcast with your host, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.
Sandra Meander, CEO of Paper.Work, is a seasoned payment strategist with over 14 years of experience in the industry. Formerly holding pivotal roles in renowned organizations like Barclays, PayPal, and Avalon US Bank, Sandra's expertise span across acquiring, issuing POS, MPOS, and APMs, both from an offline and online standpoint. Her extensive experience working with international companies have equipped her with a holistic understanding of global payment strategies, making her a trusted advisor in navigating these complex landscapes and implementing cutting-edge solutions. After years in the industry, she took a leap of faith and started her own company, Paper.Work, in 2022. Through Paper.Work, Sandra and her team supports merchants, fintechs, or banks in designing payment strategies that enhance their product propositions and unlock new opportunities. Paper.Work business model revolves around three pillars: consultancy and strategy, education and training, content creation, and visuals design. Let's begin. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Sandra to Heads Talk. Delighted to have you here today.
Very well. Good morning, Elaine. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me. Okay, let's start with this. I did it in the introduction, but can you provide us with a more detailed introduction to you, Sandra, and Paper.Work? I hope I'm pronouncing the company correctly. If you could tell me sort of the aims, the current projects and current priorities, why did you start this business?
Sure, with pleasure. And it's an honest question around whether you're saying the name right, because to be honest, a lot of people are getting it wrong. But let me just clear that first. It's Paper.Work. Essentially, it's kind of a play around the payment and the amount of, you know, steps, process, and paperwork that you need to navigate to essentially establish the right strategy. So I have been in payment for many years, about 14 years, started from a very established standpoint, working for Barclays and sort of navigated my way through smaller player, agile fintech, where I had a very different perspective in terms of some of the intricacy that essentially, sort of underline the payment infrastructure. I have had an opportunity really to broaden my skill set, not only from understanding the acquiring world, so everything around the acceptance, how payments are being taken from businesses, all the way to how they're settling in the back end. So the B2B, B2B2C are sort of the environments I've been exposed to. But I've also been exposed to the issuing side as I started working and focusing more on the travel side of the industry, where virtual card, for example, were one of the kind of rising instrument, and I'm talking five, 7 years back. And so that kind of gave me a really great rounded exposure in terms of the full end-to-end ecosystem, from the acceptance all the way to the issuance side and everything in between. I was able to work with smaller players to kind of understand those different steps. And to your point, yes, about a couple of years or so ago, I decided to set up my own consultancy called Paperwork, with essentially the focus was to help merchants. Back at the time, if you think 2022, COVID was sort of, really disrupting the landscape, the ecosystem. And what I did find at the time, because I was very close to the travel industry, was how a lot of those merchants were being exited from their relationship with their current providers. Mm-hmm. And that led me to rethink really the propositions that were available in the market, because typically, some providers are very generalist in terms of serving multi-segments, and some have a very bespoke proposition. And that is when you work in the travel or in the airline space, there's very specific technical requirements to enable a payment providers to essentially supply or to assist and support the transaction flow there. Mm-hmm. And so we have those usual suspects or providers essentially, changing the appetite in terms of still working or boarding travel businesses, that essentially left quite a big gap in the market. And I'm talking about the mid-sized businesses. I'm not talking about the big multi-million, billion, type of infrastructure that tend to, have no problem in finding the next payment providers, because everybody wants to work with multi-million business. Mm-hmm. But when you kind of like in between, you're rising, you've got an established, footprint, that became quite a challenge during COVID time. And really my passion was to start helping those merchants that don't necessarily have the in-house payment expertise, they don't have the team, and yet they're faced with really challenging situations that meant either they go bust or either they find a way around to, still maintain and operate. And payment was quite a crucial part for any business in any case to survive and sustain the challenges that were there. It wasn't vanilla type of business model I was handling. Mm-hmm. And that's just, organically opened up the opportunity for us to step into training as well, helping the industry probably realign some misconception, addressing some stereotypes, but also promoting more understanding around some basic concept to just ensure that when a merchant or payment providers are entering into business, there's a clean level field in terms of understanding what you are buying, what you can expect, and why certain kind of guidelines are in place to enable both parties to have, sort of a great relationship, partnership, and grow from, from there. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of like where we're stemming from. And we've been very lucky enough, I guess, in the beginning, because there were quite a lot of travel merchants trying to find a new home. Mm-hmm. So I would say we did not struggle to find the merchants. The part that we really struggled with was finding the right service providers that would cater for the requirement that those clients had. And I guess by passionately still trying to open and push doors, we've been able to have some success story that led to referrals and essentially put us into the scene in terms of a great partner for not only payment service providers to work with, but also merchants appreciating kind of the real support and extended partnership that we try to establish by really being their voice. And making sure that they get the right offer, the right product.
Okay. Let's talk about payments in general. As part of my research and finding more details about you and the work you do and that sort of stuff, I see dotted around your websites and promotions about your organization, I keep seeing payment strategies all over the place. So would you like to to walk me and my listeners through this. And what are you doing with corporations with the idea of payment strategies? Are you defining it for them? Or what are you, you know?
Yeah, and it's a really good question, because to be honest, up until a certain point, everybody was just talking about payment consultancy, payment expert. And I think the payment strategies, again, probably one of those buzzwords that are becoming increasingly more used. And it will be different from one person, one industry to another. But the way I see it, and the reason why I'm honing on to strategy versus consultancy, it's pretty much because of the complexity, really, that's still behind an organization to have to make the right choices and decision when it comes to that facet of enabling money in and out of the organization. If you think about what payment entails, you know, touches the regulatory compliance element, and that's a huge piece in payment. But it's also about the technical implementation. It's also about the commercial arrangement. It's also about your day-to-day operation dealing with mundane tasks that are associated with handling those transactions. So in an organization, you would have typically, let's say the organizations are quite mature in payments and have invested in having their own infrastructure. You'd have typically a person, head of payments, and you know, today people are talking about chief payment officer potentially as one of the new roles that should be emerging on the C-suite. And so when you think about that ecosystem and who ultimately is responsible for making this decision, it tends to be one kind of siloed person that have very dotted line across multiple areas of an organization. And that is where strategy really stems from, because it's not so much as a marketer that has probably a little bit more clearer defined, you know, guidelines around what does marketing stand for and what do they need to essentially pull together to establish their own strategy. Payment sits in finance, it sits in accounting, it sits in e-commerce, it's in operations. It's everything, right? And that's what strategy is about, is helping a company first and foremost understand how and where this payment sits within the organization. For one organization, payment may well just be a hybrid between, you know, e-commerce and finance. For other organization, payment may be dotted line between business intelligence, fraud, you know, legal.
There's a lot of conversions and there's a lot of crossing and blurring of lines. You mentioned the chief payment officer, that might be a potential role. Where will that individual sit? Will they sit under the CFO? Or is this a separate entity? And won't that complicate the dynamics of the C-suite?
Well, you know, this again, are very emerging conversations within the industry. And the kind of common thinking there would be to have that role essentially sitting with a direct reporting line under the CEO. Like under the CEO, you would have the CFO, so like the finance function, but you'd have payment as its standalone environment that sits on the C-suite, right?
You're saying that's separate to the CFO?
Correct. So that would be essentially its own function, C-suite on the CEO. And that's sort of like what some, you know, as with some of the conversations, some of the more established voices.
So what will that role take away from the CEO's role? Because I assume this all currently sits within the finance function, the CFO role, that sort of space. If you're going to create something separate that reports directly to the CEO as opposed to through the CFO, what will they be taking away from the CFO in order to create this role?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a question of taking away. I think it's probably more a question of adding on, because by having the role sitting its own remit and having its own responsibility, accountability, it then all of a sudden creates a much easier fluidity that, you know, will have dotted line and work in corporations with the CFO. Because the finance function, if you think payment is just an element within finance has got different realities that don't necessarily touch always payment, whilst payment has an implication in operations directly, right? Has an implication in legal, as an operation, you know, in, you know, fraud and all sorts of different areas. So by moving it, you give it the right exposure, and potentially you can allocate the resources and the environment and the ecosystem to make this strategic function, right? That gets, you know, the budget, the resource, the, you know, the processes to essentially thrive.
All right, that's interesting. That's really interesting. I didn't expect to take this angle. But going back to payment strategies, which was the original question, what difference are you seeing depending on geographical location?
Well, to be honest, that difference goes as little as even from an organizational perspective, right? So because you have to think about the nature of how a business operates, the segments and the system, payment never operates as well. Payment can operate at standalone when you're like a very small structure, but the reality, the efficiency about payment is when it is actually part of an integrated infrastructure and ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So that in itself just, you know, dictated the variation that you get all the way from an organization level, depending on the industry where they sit from. And then of course, the, you know, the segment that they're targeting in terms of the customer, their locations, their regions, then that's going to further dictate, you know, the different methods, the currencies, and some of those layers, right, that get built into the payment strategy. But it's, you know, commonly known that, you know, certain markets are driven by certain type of instruments, i.e. we're receiving here in Europe, you know, very predominantly card-driven, credit card-driven in certain areas, not others. You've got a little bit more on the Nordic that would be less, you know, driven by credits, having more wallet penetration. You've got certain regions that are, you know, really leaping forward in terms of, you know, mobile payment, mobile money, and you've got hybrids, you know, Asia that are very, very, you know, sort of ahead in terms of wallets. And, you know, so those are kind of, you know, generally common understanding that I guess, you know, within the industry people know. But of course, you have to add additional layer. And for me, you know, the industry, the segment, really dictates whether it actually makes sense, even if in that region, let's say mobile money wallet or whatever is the de facto way to pay. But if you had the layer of, as I said, for example, travel, does actually that still make sense as a combination, right? So there's so many different parameters and nuances.
Yeah. I think we could just have a podcast just on that little topic there. But let's move on. Now a question on open finance, similar to the question asked to a number of the guests on the series, sort of in recent years, what significant shifts can be observed here in the financial landscape? What are you seeing?
I guess it's no surprise to anyone that really the opportunity that has opened up open finance seems certainly here in Europe from that regulatory compliance perspective, where open banking has effectively opened the opportunity, I would say mandate and force initially, right, banks to start opening up their environment and subsequently creating new roles that were able to lead a whole new product offering from a technological standpoint. So it's been a bit of a forced relationship that had to be kind of push and mandated initiative from a regulatory standpoint. But what we're seeing increasingly is that there is a lot more sorts of collaboration, right? Because it's a threat initially when you think of the banks that have traditionally always have, you know, customer data, customer relationship, loyalty, et cetera, but they were not necessarily at the forefront in driving innovation, which naturally raised that questions around competitivity and closeness of that ecosystem. So today, I think we've passed the point where clearly we've seen models emerging, tapping and showing that this was a necessary evil somehow, because it didn't start, you know, necessarily with open hand and everybody clapping for that. It did require a lot more lobbying, conversation, alignment, and certainly seeing, you know, that collaboration where you start having a win-win situation. Because in the early stage, when you think about, okay, a mandate that dictates the bank to open their infrastructure and enable a third party to tap into, you know, the data, the information they have to then go and service and open up a new proposition. From a bank standpoint, it's like, okay, but when, where is the revenue opportunity here, right? Like everything that we have built now gets accessible through multiple parties. And I think that what we're seeing is that genuine collaborations where it is a model that benefits, right, that tackles some of the challenges that the bank on its own would not be as quick to deliver or to bring to market, with now this rise of TPP that are, you know, bridging the gap and essentially driving opportunity as well. So it's not just one side winning, it's starting mm-hmm. to become much more collaborative.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so as we firmly move towards open finance, what do you see as sort of regulatory and technological developments that are shaping this transition? And interestingly, what impact can we anticipate on consumer behavior as well as financial services?
Well, you know, from a consumer standpoint, which has always been the driver when you see regulations stepping in and when you yeah. see major break into the space, this industry, in terms of seeing, you know, emergence of products and mm-hmm. ecosystem, it's always about the consumer. So it's always about giving the options, enabling more products offering, the accessibility, et cetera, right? I think the technology as well that has sustained and enabled this to potentially kind of leap forward and really see models starting to take shape and to be used. Because it's one thing to have great new business model emerging, and it's another thing to see the adoption following it, mm-hmm. right? So I'm thinking about technologies as well, like the cloud, of course, which is today really at the backbone of how quickly we see, you know, new proposition being deployed and being scalable. Mm-hmm. And I'm also thinking about all of the advancements and the progress that's being made around the real-time processing. Right? Mm-hmm. You can say that not only we get access to a lot more greater product that, you know, come to market much quicker, and that essentially enable parties as well to enjoy that financial rewards, you know, within mm-hmm. fractions of second. So those, I think, are advancements that are starting to play across the different stakeholders, giving benefit across, you know, the different ecosystem instead of being one-sided. Now, of course, you mentioned in the introduction some of the technology like blockchain as well, which I guess has been a bit of that big elephant in the room. You know, it came into the radar. I'd say from my perspective, I'm still kind of catching up and trying to understand really where else, right? Mm-hmm. And can take what we already have today, but not just from a let's drive the innovation, but from a genuine practical standpoint where you truly see problems being solved, resolved, and customer essentially adopting and jumping into that. So I guess, yes, there are still a lot of opportunities, a lot of additional technologies that are already there or still, you know, kind of being refined.
Right. Since you mentioned additional technologies, we've got to talk about this as it is a topic on everybody's lips, regardless of the industry or political persuasion. It's the advent of generative AI. What has changed with its arrival from early 2023 to now?
Well, you know, I think this has been quite a day and night situation, because the introduction of generative AI has literally spearheaded a whole new, you know, ecosystems of products people starting to tap into. And for me, really, from where I'm sitting, in the sense of I'm helping and trying to, you know, socialize, educate the industry, mm-hmm. you can see the amount of information that almost overnight gets now populated across multiple channels, right? Mm-hmm. It is creating a bit of a buzz and a bit of a noise, right? Because mm-hmm. now you are faced with the difficulty to truly go through 10 times, 100 times more sources and content to validate mm-hmm. the right information for you. So on one hand, it's great because we have lots more information, lots more data being shared, being openly accessible. But then on the other side, there's an element of it does now require a little bit more refinement to essentially assess the source as well, right? Because Gen AI, great, But is everything coming from those sources valid? Of course not, right? And do people actually benchmark and cross-check GenAI as one of the source and not just as one of the primary source? That's where I think that there is a problem, because a lot of people are kind of jumping into this as a quick way to all of a sudden erupt as potentially an expert in any field that you want. It's a little bit of a danger, right?
Yes. But surely, I mean, I think an example you cited in terms of the data gathering, surely you were getting a lot of that already with predictive AI.
We do. And I think the great aspect of this technology is the ability to essentially assess a lot more information in a relatively condensed time, right? But I still personally don't feel not necessarily that there is a threat where GenAI is gonna absorb the expertise that strategists are bringing into the table, right? I think it's complementing it in a way that we can consume and access a lot more information.
It's complementary. You still
need to apply, your own, labor.
So how has the whole business of its appearance impacted the work that you were doing?
Well, it's been, again, a day and night situation. When the burst started last year and everybody was talking about it, I didn't jump into the wagon because I didn't understand it, right? But today, where I have seen value, and this has been by truly trying to test and run different kind of exercise or simulation through these sorts of tool, is around the ideation, right? So kind of like feeding the models with some thinking around the direction that I probably need a little bit more ideas and scoping around. That's been fantastic, because all of a sudden, strategies is not just about one mindset. It's about the diversity of views that you can actually entertain to then essentially start, weighing down into what would make sense for that specific plan. And I think for me, that's been fantastic, because I have teams of strategists, that I work organically with. And this is really the strength of what we're delivering, is those brains, those ideas, those multiple perspectives, those different nuances that things can actually be played out. So with GenAI being one of it, right? One of the source of ideas that then gets layered through practical and operational, validation, right? Because it's not just whatever gets fed from the model. It's about then taking that on and then building our own framework around that. So that I like. I think it's been really, really interesting. And also things like a lot of reports from companies, get published using those generative models to essentially screen through those reports, extracting data and information to put you straight into the picture of what is the essence there, right? That I think we can essentially absorb.
It has some uses. But, let's swiftly move on from AI, which I'm happy to do, and let's get back to payment systems and strategies. Can you tell me and my listeners the difference between payment systems, networks, schemes, and rails? I think you either wrote an article or a post on LinkedIn, and I want to pick you up on that because it was very detailed, it was very comprehensive, and I think it'd be great if you could share that in this episode.
Well, of course, those are some of my favorite topics, right? Because, we are an industry that is full of jargon, right? And the reason that struck a chord for me was, for many, many years, I used to talk about certain terms in the same way. So I used to assimilate like, a payment network is actually a payment scheme. And it's only until I started doing some research that I realized some of those little nuances. But effectively, without going too technical, the payment system, the networks, the schemes, and the rails collectively is really what underpins the money movement, right? But it has a very specific side of functions that it fulfills to enable that money movement. In a very high level, a payment system would be really the foundational framework. So this is essentially the ability of a system to move and transfer the money between the parties. So it's very much around the speed, the accessibility of the funds, the security. The networks would be the intermediaries, right? So those would actually be the institutions, the banks, the processors that have defined roles and responsibility to enable those, you know, the movement to happen. And that will be through messaging that get passed across the different parties, okay? Notable networks, payment networks are the card schemes, Visa, MasterCard, Diners, Amex, right? So these are essentially some that you can relate to. The schemes in itself, and this is something that I've just recently kind of like really got the, oh, that's something that I missed out, are essentially defined as the rules and the standards that actually govern those payment transactions. So the schemes, if I'm putting that into a banking context, would be, for example, in the US, the ACH. In Europe, that would be SEPA, right? Mm-hmm. But what's also really interesting is that a scheme can also be a payment network. And I think this is where the assimilation or the assumptions has always been there. For me, payment network is a payment scheme. Yes, it is. When you have, you know, like a Visa and MasterCard, that yes, they have the network, but they're also the scheme. But if you look at a different environment like the banking, so the scheme is actually the standard that govern that transaction. And then the rails would be the physical infrastructure that move that money, right? So the rail, again, in the banking context, an ACH would be a scheme, but will also be the rails through which the transactions get transferred. Mm-hmm. The rails can be the card through the network, Visa, MasterCard. The rail could be blockchain, right? Through this new and that get built. So that's kind of in a nutshell.
Yeah. It's listeners, it's a lot briefer than the article or the post that Sandra wrote. I'm happy to share it in the show notes if Sandra's happy for me to share that. But it was a really sort of detailed, comprehensive explanation of that. And thank you, Sandra, for providing us with sort of a succinct view of what you wrote about. And let me know if it's okay to share that in your show notes.
Thank you for suggesting it, of course.
Okay. Let's look at, you know, this series is all about, well, it's fintech, but finfluencers. And you are cited as one of the finfluencers, one of the big finfluencers on LinkedIn. So it'd be interesting to know, let's look at who influences you, Sandra. So if you could give us two inspirational individuals who have significantly influenced your views on fintech and banking, and what aspects of their work resonate with you?
Well, you know what? That was one that's been really hard to kind of pin down to two. The one that came up easy for me was Panagiotis, who's actually been one of your guests on TED Talks.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting because way before...
What's the name did you give me? Sorry, I missed that name.
Panagiotis.
Oh, yeah. He's just incredible, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes, correct. So that was, you know... one of the first names that immediately came to mind, and reason being is, you know, way before I even started paperwork, he was the first sort of person or content that I came across that was not just, you know, relaying information around fintech, because we always have that.
People just sharing other people's stuff. Anyone can do that.
Going a step further,
actually
adding his own perspective. And it was always so detailed. And I must admit, some of the narration, I could not even follow because it was that well detailed. And I was like, hold on a second, I can't even understand that. So what does that tell me in terms of some of the foundation concept that I didn't even grasp myself? And it's really led me to... go research and understand before being able to even understand a conversation that was happening within fintech, within, you know, the explosion of some of the models. It's been a huge trigger. And I think that for me, the real point is not just about telling what's happening into the space, but it's this ability to actually give a real practical, personal angle to
analyze it, and retell it so that even layman's can understand it as well.
Correct. And it's open to debate as well.
I think you do that too. I've been following your posts as well of late. And I think you do that admirably as well. You don't just share other people's content. So you just sort of share an article. You don't just share a paper. You actually analyze it, break it down, put your graphs together. And I think that's fantastic. And as a a LinkedIn user, I appreciate that because I know the amount of work that tends to go into these things, and I think that's fantastic that you do that. So I apologize for interrupting, but you can continue.
So I think just to probably loop with the point you made around generative AI, that's really for me the difference between authenticity and potentially just AI generated content, right? A lot of people can go out there and talk about a lot of different topics, but it's really about taking it from a personal standpoint and not be afraid, because to be honest, because payment is and fintech is that complex, there are opinions and points that you're going to put across that people are going to disagree with, because it actually doesn't resonate in the space where they are. And I think it's being bold and prepared to have those conversations and those debates. And I think that is one thing that AI are not going to take your job away.
I must admit, we're saturated with AI, the AI LinkedIn post. And I've noticed quite a lot the AI comments. You know how people talk, you know how people converse, and you know if it's English is not their first language, and then you see these AI generated comments, I just switch off. I just don't want to read it because it's just torture. You want to read the personalities talking, not the AI generated comments.
That's right. And then with the second one, it's really hard for me to, because apart from, let's say, penetrating is a feed that I have, like, he posts at 7 o'clock in the morning and I'm onto the feed at 7 o'clock. I know there's going to be something. There's a lot more people and I couldn't even come to do justice to pick one. And I just thought, you know what? There's some brilliant women as well that I wanted to probably put into the radar, because I think there's been way too much male voices. And what's really interesting is to see women as well starting to build, you know, their own, you know, stand. And taking, you know, that visibility. And I think it's really great to start seeing the balance with, you know, women voice.
That makes sense. Okay, let's end this episode of Head to Talk looking ahead, as we normally do. What are the plans for you, Sandra Meandra, and paper.works for the year ahead, or even the year after?
So, you know, we've had such an organic journey. Like, as I said, we started as consultants, but then the journey took us to this content strategy as well, which is a pillar of the service that we offer today, along with the training. Those were never planned. So what we're really focusing on today is really starting to consolidate our proposition. You know, when you start in your first year, you do a bit of everything, because consultancy means everything, right? It's led by different projects and the different requirements. But what we've seen and what we've come to understand is, where do we stand in terms of our niche, right? Where do we stand out? Because it's really about exploiting that and not just being, oh, another strategy company advisors into the scene. It's really about exploiting and doing what we do best. So for us, we are essentially redesigning our service offering, which has three pillars now. We are aligning branding as well, right? Because you've picked up on me, seeing me on LinkedIn as that influencer being mentioned across maybe a few of the different lists. But it's important for people to understand that, oh, I'm really appreciative of being seen as an influencer, but I run a company and the company has got a service offering and the service offering is XYZ, right? So I think it's stepping up the corporate game a little bit more, right? That's something I have not done. I have not done a lot, and now I'm starting to become probably a little bit more corporate, you know, establishing processes, you know, to showcase.
Oh, good. That's important.
Yeah. And so, yeah.
Okay. So these are the stuff we've got to look forward to with you, Sandra. That's fantastic. And if there's anything new that I don't know, you produce that you want me to stick in your show notes, just give me a DM and I will update your show notes for those looking into your episode. Sandra Meandra, an insightful and enjoyable conversation today on Head to Talk today. And at last, we've managed to do the recording. Many thanks for your time and insights.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for bearing with me as well, Elaine.
Thanks for joining me today on this episode of Heads Talk. Don't forget to subscribe to the show via my website, elainepringle.com/heads talk, or wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, I'd like to thank our sponsors, guests, and you for helping to make the show possible. Please join me next time where I'll be featuring more executives, C-suite leaders, and heads of multinationals.
Heads Talk Podcast with your host, Elaine Pringle-Schwitter.